Hello, my name is Joshua Gilliland. I'm one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. And with me is Charles Hildebrandt. And we are going to talk Star Wars for a special Star Wars Day episode. Charles, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Josh. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a media, entertainment, and copyright and trademark lawyer. And I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. I've worked in film and television and games and books and plays, and I've represented actors and writers and producers and game designers, you name it. But I'm also, for purposes of today's conversation, a diehard science fiction and fantasy fan from way back. And I have a very personal connection to Star Wars. And that's through my family. My dad was not a lawyer. He was a professional artist. And he had a very long career spanning decades. He died in 2006. But before that, he had worked in publishing and in some cases in the film industry and advertising. And he had done just about anything that could be painted, he did it. And so he would do book covers for sure was a mainstay, and dozens of them. He had done calendars and record album covers, and some cases ads in magazines for cat food. You name it, he did it. He had grown up, and I had grown up as a science fiction fan, as science fiction and fantasy fans. From my earliest memory of my dad was that he was waking me up at 3 a.m. so that we could watch the 1953 War of the Worlds film, which was being played, on a UHF channel sometime in the early 70s. Yeah. That's how life used to work. You had to wait for something to come on. For a little more context, around the time that Star Wars came out, my dad was already at this point a pretty well-established artist. And he and my uncle had been pretty famous for making a series of calendars on The Lord of the Rings, some folks from that era might remember. Very early in 1977, my dad got a call from a New York advertising agency. We lived in the New York metropolitan area at the time. And he said, come on in. I got a job for you. I need you to do a movie poster. Now, my dad had done this before. It wasn't, a lot of minor films, but so it wasn't new to him, but we'll come on in. Goes into New York and meets in a very small advertising agency and said, okay, here's the deal. There's a new science fiction film that's coming out in a few months, and the existing advertising art, nobody's really that happy with, and they're looking for some new movie poster for ad purposes. Now, it's important to remember also that at this time in the 70s, the movie poster was a more significant portion of the advertising campaign for any film release than it is now, because that was what was printed in newspapers, physical newspapers, as to advertise films, and that was how most people found, decided what they were going to watch on any particular weekend. They'd open up the newspaper and look at the movie section and see a huge array of posters and images saying, available in these theaters. And that was the means of the principal means of publicity. Because of that, they needed to have a single iconic image that was just used over and over and over again and got associated with the film. All right, so as they, my dad and my uncle arrive in at the advertising agency, the little ad agency explains, okay, so here's the deal. We got this, we need you this movie poster, but here's the thing. This is a rush and we really need this as soon as possible. Frankly, can you get this to us tomorrow? Is that possible? Tomorrow, well, that's gonna be a challenge, but okay, well, we'll do it as soon as we can. But that's tough. what is this film? What it's about? Well, it's a science fiction film. We don't really know too much about the story. They gave him a very brief rundown, a very brief overview. There's rebels, there's an empire. That's almost it. Don't have much to show you. Here is a stack of black and white photographs. They gave him a big stack of 8x10 black and white glossies. Take these home. That's it. You know, this is the idea. Okay. That seems odd. Do you have anything more? Do you have, maybe some actors, publicity photos? No. Don't worry about it. Here's the thing. This movie is terrible and no one is even going to ever see this poster or care about it. Oh, okay. All right. So I went home and, the next morning, that was in an afternoon in New York. And then the next morning, I got up and, you know, my dad put me in the car to drive me to school that morning. Now, I was 9 at the time, and I was already a huge science fiction and fantasy fan at 9 years old, right? So I had, you know, 2001 and the Planet of the Apes and whatnot. And of course, Star Trek, I was a huge Star Trek fan. I had even already been to a Star Trek convention the year earlier in 1976. So I was prime audience for this sort of thing. I sit down, my dad hands me the stack of 8x10 glossy photos and said, Charles, I've got a new job for a movie poster for a science fiction movie. And I'm sitting in the car as he's driving and I start paging through the photos and they were mostly on set photography. So, you know, it was stormtroopers marching around the Death Star and you know, photos of Luke and Han and so on. A very few effects shots. There were, you know, one shot of a TIE fighter and an X-wing and, you know, just a couple Death Star shots, not much, all in black and white. And I'm paging through it. He said, oh, Charles, I don't really know anything about this movie. I know there's some strange names in it. There's a character named Chewbacca and there's somebody else named Darth Vader. I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. But I don't know much more. And they tell me this movie is bad. And I remember looking through the photos when he said that. And I said, Dad, I don't know. It looks pretty good. So I can think of myself as a very early pro Star Wars critic, you know, as the prime audience for this. Anyway, so he does the poster. Takes them about 36 hours to do it, actually, working in shifts. And they send it off. It's done. About a week later, actually, they came in for some changes. They said, you know, we have some additions for you. And this is, again, no Photoshop. So making additions to a painting required actually go there with your paints and physically paint on the painting, which they did at the advertising agency, which is just a strange thing to do. But yeah, the original version of it didn't have 3PO and R2 there. And then the weirdest addition. They said, can you put your name bigger on the poster? You see, in 1977, no one had heard of Star Wars or George Lucas, Darth Vader, but because of things like the Tolkien calendars and book covers, my dad's name meant something. So this goofy idea was that they somehow, you know, poor Star Wars needs all the help it can get, and somehow putting that name larger on the movie poster was gonna help the film. Okay. They do that. All right. So then many months pass. And, I was, again, this is not like now. There's no internet. So there really wasn't like a publicity machine churning out stuff about this upcoming movie. There was really nothing to know. You could read a few things in Starlog magazine, which is essentially the only source for stuff that was coming up. Yeah, it's, you remember, there's the only stuff that was coming up in science fiction and fantasy, and that was it. But that was it. That was truly it. So largely, we had all kind of forgot about it until May of 77. And we, at that time, we got in the mail, out of the blue, tickets to go to the New York area premiere of the show, the initial booking premiere. I'll explain that in a minute too. So they sent us 4 tickets and my mom, my dad and I went and we had one left over and there it is. That's what it looked like. That's the real thing. It's pretty cool. All right. that day comes along and we go into New York, go to the theater, which was this colossal theater in Times Square that was located two levels down underneath the ground, like below, like deep under the like subway level, but just absolutely enormous. And I had, I obviously had never been there before, but it, that theater apparently was still in operation up until like 10 years ago. Anyway, so we file in to this gigantic theater. And as I said before, this is the New York premiere for booking agents. And let me explain that. Back then in 1977, there was no AMC. There was no Regal Cinemas. Those giant theatrical chains just didn't exist. And if you wanted to get your movie shown in theaters, you had to make deals with independent theater owners, you know, chains that might own 10 in a region or five or two, or a guy might just own one theater, whatever. There were agents for that, like agents for everything. But by and large, it was a matter of showing the movie to these folks and letting them decide to take it, just like that. Outside of films with major stars, nothing was pre-booked. They just saw the movie, decide whether they're going to take it. That's what this showing was for. All right, so we file into this giant theater, and on every single seat in this huge theater, there was something interesting sitting on the seat. So they had two things, actually. One was there was a little pamphlet, here it is, just giving the technical crew whatnot. And that was just sitting there. And then this, by the way, is kind of the normal thing that was at any kind of any booking premiere, this one sheeter, right? But they've done something else. Fox, at the same time, had printed out thousands of these, by the way, but they printed out a full explanatory booklet explaining the universe of Star Wars, having pronunciation keys for the character names, explanations of what's going on. Because we don't think about this now, but there was something that was very radical about Star Wars and that Fox was terrified of at the time. And that is, this was the first time there had ever been a major theatrical release of a movie wherein that film did not take place on Earth or have any connection to Earth or mention to Earth. It was a completely fantasy universe. Again, we don't really think much of that now, but at the time, unheard of. And they were terrified that no one would understand that, that it was just like that was impossible to understand, and that they needed literally these books. By the way, for the first week of production of release, Fox was still distributing these to theaters, because I know folks who got these in that first week in the first week of release. Okay, so we sit down, and this is a premiere, and there's no trailers, no coming attractions, no get your popcorn, none of that. The movie just starts. It's just, this is it. Boom. John Williams plays, and the Star Destroyer flies over. And at that point, this audience, filled with New York metro area theatrical booking agents, possibly the most cynical audience imaginable, right, is captured. They love it. You can feel it. Everybody's like, whoa. It's amazing. And, you know, it just gets better and better. And again, this incredibly cynical audience, by the end, everyone is cheering and standing up when the Death Star explodes, fists in the air. Yeah! I've never seen anything like it. And they applaud the screen at the end. Wow. Okay. So now it's time to come out of the theater, and we file out. You know, I'm singing John Williams music. I'm not alone. And as we file up, and remember, this is a theater that was two levels below the street level. So there, you had to go up two sets of escalators to get out. And coming out of the theater and going up to the first set of escalators, the second set above the theater, is the level where there were row and row and rows of payphones. This is for our younger viewers. A payphone is like a cell phone stuck to a wall that you've got to pay to use, a public phone. Anyway. And I could see guys lined up in the phone booths, right, waiting to use the phones, because they were all on the phone saying, take it for as many weeks as you can, take it. I say book it as long as you can. Here, and you can just hear them over, like, take it, take it, take it. Wow. Okay. So then lastly, we got the last set of escalators going out, and the ushers had huge plastic buckets filled with "May the force be with you" buttons that they were handing out to everyone as they left. And there's mine from 76. And so there it is. So I went home and I, you know, and oh, everyone was captured, was talking about it. My dad loved it. And he, you know, in his words, it was like being a kid again. It was kind of like growing up in the movies in the 50s and 40s. And, you know, of course it took the world by storm, right? And then everybody knew about Star Wars, right? I didn't realize something about this story, which I have told obviously hundreds of times in my life. But until my daughter first saw Star Wars and a few years ago, and when my daughter, you know, showed her the films and I explained all this to her and told her this story, and my daughter's reaction was, "Dad, that means you were one of the first kids ever to see Star Wars." And I realized, oh yeah, that's true. I was. Yeah, that's absolutely right. It had never occurred to me, but yeah, I was. I, you know, maybe only by a few days, but I was one of the very first kids to ever see it. So there you go. and my dad also, I mean, and you know, obviously that's the original, that's not the painting. That's a photo reproduction, but the, although that one's a funny one because actually it's signed by Mark Hamill and he says, "Thanks for the physique, Tim." Because Mark is funny, but later on he did do other Star Wars work over the years. Like, you know, he had been magazine covers and stuff over the years. Some of the originals you see behind these are original paintings. That's from the Shadows of the Empire trading card set, which came out in the 1990s. If you're the right age, you may remember. But yeah, and that's it. And then of course, you know, over the years, one of the funny, it's just so odd the way history works is that this image ended up becoming one of the most iconic and recognizable Star Wars images, right? This thing, which was done, you know, in an incredible rush with no expectation that anyone would ever see it, ends up becoming, you know, oh, here it is on the lunchbox, you know, and like, here it is on my shoes, you know. It's like, it's just everywhere. And yeah, my dad had no notion that was ever going to happen, but there it is.
On one level, that's like a purely American story. It's like, yeah, none of us knew. Like
yeah.
Who knew that would be like that big? And it's like, well, yeah, it's just, no one starts out thinking this will be earth shattering.
Right. And if anyone, oh yeah.
And those who do think that are usually wrong. Like they very few people do the Babe Ruth, "I'm going to point to the stands where I'm going to knock the home run."
Like, yeah.
People who do that normally fall on their face. So
yes, yeah. No, it's true. Yeah, that's absolutely right. It is true. but he tapped something. I mean, and he tapped, so much of it, of course, is luck. It's the time. Precisely the right time to release something like that and you know, resonating in exactly the same way. But it's more to that. I mean, because if that had been all it was, well, we wouldn't be talking about it today, right? I mean, we'd still be, yeah. So it has survived and thrived and prospered and changed in a lot of ways. But, you know, here we are.
Well, Star Wars does a really good job of connecting with people on a fundamental level. And the target age group is between 5 to 70. They it's like I think Star Wars toys are a perfectly acceptable gift for a woman in her 40s. Like it's totally, it'd be weird not to do that. It'd just be very inconsiderate. And,
absolutely.
It's like, and I have given many action figure gifts over the years, since 2015, when Disney, you know, or was it 2013 when Disney made the purchase, and then by the time that it was announced that Force Awakens was coming out, we were starting to see cool swag again.
Right. So here, and on that line, so you know, again, here is the original Star Wars Boxco action figures from 1977. These were mine. This is, you may have seen the vaunted set you had to turn to send away for because there were no toys in 77 for that Christmas. That's right. That's them. Though that was me. And yeah, I went like every day to the post office starting on February 1st of 78, waiting for those to arrive. Here they are. So. There you go.
Yeah, so I was 3 months shy of turning three when Star Wars came out, and we're 3.5 months. So again, I was two-ish.
Right.
My brother was born in that June. So, but Star Wars played in theaters for like a year. So yes. I do remember seeing it at a drive-in. And
wow, okay.
So very formative memory, but it does have that childhood fog to it.
Yeah.
It's something that I've always been aware of. Seeing Empire was a much clearer memory because I was five.
Right.
And so that was, Empire on some levels is a richer memory because of, I was like a target age for a seminal movie event. And the, my mother took me to see it in San Jose at Dome Theaters that we used to have. They just recently were torn.
The one that just recently closed. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, the Century 20, actually, that's in LA. Starlight. Oh. I took my brother to go and his girlfriend to go see The Last Jedi there. And it was the night that Ryan William Johnson was playing a Usher, you know, to get fan reaction. I'm pretty sure I walked by him with snacks. Because I saw it the night before with other friends. And so I was the one, I sent them in and I did the snack run. And I do remember a guy that I passed who was a theater employee. It's like,
so looks a lot like Ryan Johnson. Yeah, that's great.
It's like, is it? No, is it? Maybe? I don't know. So, but it was a cool experience. But when I was five, you know, no pre-booked tickets. So the line went through the parking lot.
Yeah.
So I remember sitting on a blanket with my mom, traffic going around us.
Yes.
And as she told the story, I didn't move or blink the entire runtime of the movie, and because it was super important to me.
It is.
And I still remember the screams and object terror with, no, I am your father. And it's really hard to have a cultural moment and to have others understand that, because you know, that's 41 years ago now.
Right.
No other movie has had that shock value.
Yeah, I can't think of it. I agree. I'm not sure I can think of anything that has that kind of resonance. Yeah, that's right. I agree. I mean, you really, there are a few that are kind of in that vein, but nothing like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Thunderstruck.
Yeah.
And like the way that Luke is traumatized by it, the audience was too.
Yeah.
And that's powerful storytelling. That's people who are really invested and feel for the characters.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, like going to like a convention, whether it's San Diego Comic-Con or Celebration, and being with others who feel the same, who feel the same connection to that source material. It's why I think when we do a panel about legal issues from Star Wars, it fills the room because people understand the facts as, you know, like what happened on screen.
Right.
Vader modifying the contract with Lando Calrissian is a great way to discuss duress.
And it's true.
It can't be consideration for a contract modification. I'm going to leave a garrison here unless you take the deal. That's stress.
that.
That's right. You, it's not valid.
good luck going to a court that will, you know, strike that down. But
you know, I've heard in the past a good analogy for this, and that is, to the extent that Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey formed the cultural touchstones for classical civilization, right? That's what everyone related to, right? In ancient Greece and in the Roman Empire, if you wanted to talk to someone and make an analogy, you made an analogy to something from the Odyssey, that because everybody would understand that. That's what this place the Star Wars fills in our modern American society, and maybe modern Russian society, but certainly modern American society. It's a thing, it's a fantasy universe, but that everyone knows, and you can make the reference to, and they instantly understand. And I think it's fulfilling that place in our civilization.
Absolutely. And there's an emotional core to it that people are drawn to.
Yep.
And why, you know, you get psychiatrists who discuss mental health issues, and they use Star Wars as an example for it, or theologians who do as well. And I remember 2015 coming home from like a legal event and plane flight. I was sitting next to a pastor, and this was like October or November. And he said, "I'm looking forward more to Star Wars than I am Christmas." And
Christmas comes every year. Well, you know, come on. Come on.
And having Star Wars release dates around Christmas, it makes sense.
It does. Absolutely.
I remember Christmas 1980, there was an AT-AT and two snow speeders that morning. And like, that was super cool.
To
have that. So you grew up with like a connection to Star Wars that's truly.
Yeah.
Special.
Yeah.
As a dog barks in the distance. So from 77, who was your favorite character?
Yeah, that's an interesting. Yeah. I will say I was, you know, my age was exactly right. So I was 10 at that point, and I was, again, as I said, I was already an enormous science fiction and fantasy fan by far. And so I was exactly the right age, I think, to identify with Luke Skywalker, right? Like that was probably, favorite is the wrong word, but I would say if I was putting myself in the movie, at that moment, I did see myself as Luke Skywalker, right? I was the kid. In terms of like the character I thought was the most fun, I absolutely thought Han Solo was more fun. And mostly because he had his own ship, right? So he was in charge of the ship. He was kind of like Captain Kirk, except that, he was like a rogue version of Captain Kirk. And like that was very appealing. So I thought he was really super cool and funny, and I enjoyed him. But I thought, in terms of, so I guess my favorite character was Han Solo, but the character I identified most with was Luke Skywalker. How about that?
That, I think from a human development standpoint, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
From, especially for young people, because they'll identify likely with Luke, but they'll also want to be Han.
Yeah.
I get that. I think there's a, no, I don't quite remember this, but there's the fact that like Han leaves, Yavin 4 with the money. And it's like, he's quite the mercenary. And in like the surprise was that he comes back to take the shot.
Right.
Like hearing audio from theater goers, there were cheers.
Oh yeah. That was a huge moment even in that premiere. Absolutely. That was a huge moment, and it was unexpected. Nobody thought, he's back. Okay. Yeah. That was great.
Nine movies later, it's like, oh yeah, of course he went back. But
it was not clear that he would do that at all. No, not in the least. Part of what made Star Wars in 77 so powerful, ironically, is that there wasn't this giant universe of lore and established characters and development in history and universe. None of that existed. We were all seeing this brand new. It was completely new, right? It wasn't a thing we already knew about. And that's what even made it more special. I don't think it's possible to recapture that today for anyone, even because today, you know, however young you are, when you see Star Wars, you've already seen Star Wars, right? It already exists as a thing. It isn't new. So I don't think that can be recaptured.
No, it'd have to be a completely different property. You know, it's like the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie had a fundamental connection with a lot of young people.
Right.
And like it also predated Force Awakens. So, right. You know, you get that factor as well.
But even something like Guardians of the Galaxy and all of the Marvel movies for that matter, and there are some really great films in there, but they already exist, right? So these are characters from the 1960s. Again, you already knew all about them. Even if you weren't a fan, you knew what Iron Man is. I mean, you've seen it, you know, it wasn't completely new. I mean, it's been a long time. The nature of the media universe is such that it's hard to have something completely new and have it break through. I mean, in some sense, the 1980s were kind of the peak of that, right? When, you know, the first time the Terminator stood up at the end of Terminator is a shock, like, what, you know? But seeing things new, it's hard today. It just is.
Yeah. I think Mandalorian succeeded because watching the first episode and you get the reveal of Grogu. I was honestly shocked. It's like, I did not see that coming. Final episode of season two with Luke, you know, like that reaction of just losing it and seeing what everyone wanted to see, a full-fledged Jedi Knight just going to town on a bunch of battle droids was something Star Wars fans have wanted for decades.
Right. And it was brilliantly staged. I loved my wife and I were sitting on, you know, on our couches. We're watching that last episode. And you know, the first time the X-Wing shows up, we're like, wait, is that really him? Could that be him? Is that no. Is that really? Oh, it is. Yeah, it is. It is. It's gonna be him. It's exactly what we were doing.
There are reaction videos that are priceless.
Oh, like, yeah, I bet. Yeah, yeah.
It just people, it's, you know, like losing their minds with, it's Luke, and it's just like beautiful. So Mandalorian's pulled it off. I'm optimistic. What can they do on Andor or Kenobi if they're able to recreate anything like that? Or is this something where it just won't fit? Like maybe it's, you know, it's tough to go, this will be a watershed moment that everyone will talk about. It's just hard to pull that off from,
right. Yeah.
It'd be like going in, this case management conference will set the tone for all lawyers going forward. It's like, it's a CMC, like you just, come on, you know.
yeah, it's hard. On the other hand, the change in kind of the dominant cultural media, changing from a 2-hour standalone film to becoming a long form television miniseries, like that's now the cultural touchstone, right? That's what we all watch. That does leave open the possibility of. I think that kind of cultural impact, and because we saw it. I was just thinking about this. While the movies may not be able to produce a "No, I am your father" moment anymore, I think TV shows, long form TV shows, can. Think about the impact of Game of Thrones, right, and the twists of Game of Thrones, and how that was just, you know, that was a thing everyone was watching and everyone is paying attention to. So it can happen. But yeah, it's hard to pull it off in a 2-hour film these days, for sure.
Or the, I recently watched Invincible on Amazon Prime, and the end of that first episode, it's animated. J.K. Simmons is one of the lead voices, but that does have a shocking.
It does a shocking moment. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, whoa, did not see that coming. And it is very well done. Yeah. So again, hope springs eternal that that storytelling can be done in a way that has that emotional investment where people are just so drawn in and you know, then they care.
And they
like
care.
How, again, as human beings, we enjoy the storytelling element. And there's, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, since we're lawyers, I thought it'd be fun to just do some quick spot checking issues from the original film. So one thing that I've always wondered about is what happened to the crew on the Tantive IV? Because all those guys are taken as POWs. Were they killed? Were they sent to a prison camp? Were they, if they were sent to the Death Star, that would have sucked.
So I think, and this is, I would say this, and I think there's some evidence for this in the film, starting off with just holding her as dangerous. If word of this gets out, it will generate sympathy for the rebellion in the Senate. And but generally the structure of that film is such that you see the authoritarian crackdown and the change from at least the pretense of democracy to pure authoritarianism is happening during the movie. It is still an ongoing process. It's one of the reasons I really love the 77 film is that there's a real sense that, you know, the universe isn't static, right? The empire is not a monolith. At the beginning of the film, there's a Senate. Princess Leia says, I'm a member of the Imperial Senate on a diplomatic mission. And that has meaning, right? That apparently, you know, there are laws, there's this, it's in effect. But obviously the Senate gets abolished there, the regional governors take over. The model that Lucas had talked about in some interviews was he's talking about, obviously, the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the change to Nazi Germany, but also the collapse of the Roman Republic and the switch to the empire, right, which were processes, right? This is a thing where it happened over time. But in both of those cases, at least at some level, the switch to from a Republican semi-democratic government to an authoritarian one was legal, right? Like, you know, the Nazis got 30% of the vote, they formed a coalition government, and so on and so on and so on. This was not a government imposed by force by external conquest, right? This was a legal dictatorship. Same is true of the Roman Republic to a large extent. And I think that's what Lucas was doing. He said so, I mean, very early on, he was talking about those were his models. If that's true, the answer is, well, they were not killed. They weren't massacred. They were taken prisoner to put for trials, for show trials, because they're the legal government, right? So these folks were committing treason and they're going to be rounded up and they're going to be tried for treason. And that's the law, right? Now, you may not agree with it. And you may have policy disagreements with the emperor, but he's still the emperor. And he's legally the emperor. And, you know, that's it. That's the job. So I think also, as a practical matter, if he wanted to kill them, all they need to do is open the airlocks and vent them into space. You really don't need to do anything exotic, which leads us to the next point, right? Like, they didn't do that. And they didn't just blow up the ship, right? They're clear. The Empire is there to capture them, hold them, hold trials, and, you know, prosecute which criminals, traitors to the Empire. We are heroes, but sad to say, on the wrong side of the law. And you and I, in the Star Wars universe, I gotta say, I'm sorry to say, you gotta break this to you, but our law licenses would be issued by the Empire, not by the rebels, and we know where we would be working.
Also, I mean, this is Shakespeare's point about kill all the lawyers. We would have been lined up and shot fairly early on.
That's a different, yeah. To the extent that, right, yeah, exactly. If there were any opposition early on, they were gone.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, it also gives credence to what's on Wikipedia that the ship survived.
Yeah.
And so we do see it's the same ship in Rise of Skywalker. So meaning that Leia gets it back. So that thing was an Imperial impound.
And well built. Well built. Yeah. It's just really very durable. That's good stuff. Yeah. Imperial Impound. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's exactly right.
It also makes sense. Our naval ships last decades.
Yeah.
So like when we build an aircraft carrier, that's a 50-year investment. Like
right.
We're not planning to build, a new one. Like there's, just news reports about they're dismantling the Kitty Hawk.
Right.
And she was in dry dock for 2 years to scrape all the barnacles off so there was no invasive species for where it's going to be taken apart. And that ship had 50 years of service. The Enterprise as well, again,
right.
50 years of service.
Right.
And so it would make sense that if you build a starship that's a blockade runner, they're going to be built to last.
Even crazier, think about the fact that, the current plan for the lifespan of the B-52 airframe is to keep them flying perhaps close to 80 or 100 years.
But it gets to a point like, okay, that's just lazy. Like, yeah. We could build a better bomber at this point in time. B-52s have had three generations from families flying B-52s.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
It's going to be like somewhere between 4 to 6 at this rate. So it's like, I'm build a new plane. Like yeah. There's a, because it's like there was a debate in the Navy about the new Zimwalt destroyers.
Yes.
And some admiral that had a thing for the, was it the Aegeus destroyers? Yeah. He won, it's trying to play the shell game. Like, we can just modernize the old ones.
We'll modernize the old ones. Yeah, I don't have a Zimwalt. I'm very disappointed about that because the Zimwalt looks so damn cool. It looks like a science fiction ship. And of course, as you know, the captain who commands the first of the Zimwalt destroyers is Captain James Kirk. Yeah, so come on. That's kismet.
Other legal issues that I thought about. Did Kenobi have a duty to help Leia after getting her message? Your thoughts.
Well, I'm going to go with what I just said before, which is if you presume that the government of the Empire is the legal government, not only did Kenobi not have a duty to help her, Kenobi had a duty to turn her into the Imperial Bureau of Investigation, right? She's plotting treason against the Empire.
I would disagree with that, going from a different perspective, a different point of view, if you will. And that is that the true government was the Republic, and the Empire was founded upon a lie. It was founded upon treason by Palpatine and staging the Clone Wars in order to weaken the Republic so an authoritarian government could take over. So Kenobi's allegiance and Leia's allegiance are to the notion of a republic, which was violently overthrown with a lie because the elected leader committed treason.
But it wasn't violently overthrown. And here's we're back to the Weimar Republic. And Lucas did keep that in the prequels, which was, it wasn't violently overthrown. It was voted, right? So it's kind of like the Nazis.
If you ignore the Clone War, then sure. No.
Well, okay. I see. All right. That's fair. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. And you ignore the massacre at the Jedi Temple. So, but that gets to the fact that the Jedi should have had a special prosecutor. They should have, gone through an impeachment trial as opposed to, we'll go arrest the chancellor ourselves, but that's
right.
A separate discussion of don't do it like that.
Yeah, that is a separate discussion.
Let's get to the Death Star. Obi-Wan goes off to turn off the shield or the tractor beam. And that's when R2 learns that Leia is imprisoned on the Death Star. And having that knowledge, This raises the issue, did Luke, Han, and Chewbacca have a duty to rescue Princess Leia from the Empire?
Did Luke, Han, and Chewbacca have a duty to break out a prisoner who is charged with treason by the legal government and commit a crime and attempt to free her from custody? No. I'm sticking with this. No, I don't think so. It's hard to make that stick. I mean, I don't think so. Han Solo, let's be clear about this. And nobody's denying this. Han Solo is a criminal, right? I mean, we all admit he's a smuggler, he's a pirate, you know. We know this. So a duty, legal duty? No, absolutely not. Again, we're back to I don't think so. It's like, you know, it's breaking somebody out of Guantanamo Bay.
Or is it breaking a refugee out of one of the internment camps that Trump had for children?
Is it? Exactly. That's your point. Right. Think of it that way, right? So we're Guantanamo Bay, either one, right? Like, okay, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What should I do there, right? But the answer is it's illegal, right? Maybe you have a moral duty to do it, and I certainly can.
It'd be one thing if like we're dealing with Nazi Germany and we're trying to go liberate a concentration camp. That's a nice clear cut, like, no, we're gonna go in and we're gonna go in guns blazing and we're gonna go save those people. Like, that's a nice clear example.
Right. That's a black and white case that almost never happens in reality. But right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's never that clean. The children who, refugee children forcibly separated from their parents in order to, and put in horrid conditions as a form of sending a message that—
Right, as an act of national foreign policy, right, as an intentional act of policy, yeah.
Arguably in violation of international law, because now you're targeting refugees.
Targeting refugees, absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. All of that's bad. So the reaction to that is, what happened? Like, you had lawyers cowboy up. There was also groups of mothers who were lawyers who went all guns blazing to go fight for those kids.
Yeah.
They did it through legal means to help those
That's
kids.
The thing, right? So they operated with, that's the thing. They operated within the structures of the legal system, which for all of its flaws, and the political system, for all of its flaws, we still accept as being the legitimate source of power, authority, and a legitimate state, right? Like the state, the United States, is still a legitimate source of authority, and that we recognize that we should work within those structures. And the question is, you know, all right, Star Wars, well, they don't believe that. Like, they don't accept that the Empire is a legitimate government. Even though, as I argue, I think it, legally speaking, it probably is, but that's, you know, but they don't accept that. Yeah.
Yeah, but legitimate governments don't blow up planets. So that would be like us going, we're tired of refugees from Honduras, so we're going to nuke Honduras.
Right. So we've nuked two cities. And, you know, but yeah, so yeah, I'm just going to point that out.
War is different. So.
We're back to, is it ever a clear cut? Obviously the Death Star is a metaphor for nuclear weapons, and obviously the destruction of Alderaan is at some level harkening back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Obviously, that's sort of the intent. I don't think, what I always say about Hiroshima and Nagasaki is, like, if I were Harry Truman, I would think two things, which is, one, this is a crime against humanity. And I do think it is. It was a crime against humanity to drop nuclear weapons on women and children in Friday. It's absolutely a crime against humanity. But if I had been Harry Truman, I'm certain I would have committed that same crime against humanity. I would have done it. And it's hard to imagine. We can look back on it now and say, oh, well, you should have thought it differently. I don't know that you could have, especially given, you know, what had happened just immediately before.
Because that ignores the entire war.
And like, it does. And that's, yeah.
Because there's the concept of proportionality, and the Japanese were the first to target civilians. You know, look at the 25 million dead Chinese.
The Chinese, absolutely, horrific, yeah. But that doesn't change the fact that it's still us nuking women and children and you know, and it doesn't, you know, like, does that make it okay? It makes it understandable, but does it make it okay? No, I don't get it. But yeah, right.
My maternal grandfather, who just turned 100, was on the USS Boxer, which was the lead ship in the invasion of Japan. And so the bombs worked. So
the bombs worked, and they saved his life. Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't have to invade, which would have killed far more people.
Absolutely.
And
like, and far more Japanese. Not just, you know, yeah, to be clear, without a doubt. Yeah.
So, I mean, we had already been firebombing.
Yep.
Because, again, total war at that point.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. We haven't experienced total war since World War II, thank God.
No.
But that's when civilians are also in play, just as they are with throughout the Cold War. Like, yeah. if it was going to get hit with a nuke, like, everybody dies.
But I think it's a difference. The difference is this. I agree with all of that, by the way. Absolutely. You're completely true. Not disagreeing with any of that. But I do think also our sense of morality is dependent on the means of the death. And I say this simply because, okay, we can say things like what you just said, which is, you know, well, we've already been firebombing and we nuked them and everything else that happened. Yeah, true. But you can debate whether that might be a war crime. But if the U.S. Army had lined up 100,000 civilians in Hiroshima, including babies, and ordered soldiers to shoot them in the head one at a time, right? Absolutely no one would try to claim that that was not a crime against humanity. And so one of the most horrible things that ever happened. And yet, what's the difference? What's the difference? The difference is it's instead of thousands of troops having to push a button, the trigger, to kill someone, it was one guy who had to push a button to kill someone. Just like it was the one guy on the Death Star with the commenced primary ignition. You know.
But we didn't, again, comparing it to the Death Star, that would have been like blowing up all of Japan in one fell blow.
Yeah.
And no, we're done.
Right. But presumably it was the head to save it. The intent was the same, right? It was to squash our opposition by using a means that was so over the top that no one could even imagine resisting after that. So essentially they're trying to do the same, even if, yeah.
But ironically, they did resist. I mean, there was the attempted military coup.
Yeah.
And you had, because the emperor and others were like, we got to call it a day. Like, we're done.
Right.
And you had the elements that wanted to keep fighting to the last man.
Yeah. And
luckily, calmer heads prevailed and we were able to end the war.
Yeah.
Comparatively, there was no one to sue peace with after Alderaan, because the name Death Star implies original war crime. It's like, we're here to just kill.
Right.
And, you know, and Mandalorian, again, highlighting just the fact that you have people who really understand Star Wars who are writing this. Last episode of season 2, on board the shuttle, where you have Cara Dune talking to one of the pilots, and the pilot is taunting her with about he was on the Death Star.
I was on the Death Star, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And destroying Alderaan was a good thing if that meant stopping all of you terrorists, which again, that's like saying the only way to stop the terrorists is to kill their families, which would be utterly horrifying if an elected official said that. And
I don't know about you, but I do remember in the aftermath of 2001 and the 9/11 attacks, there were people calling for massive attacks on Afghanistan of that order.
And luckily, we resisted.
We did. Yeah.
And the fact that Bush actually asked the military to plan dropping food onto Afghani civilians.
Right.
It's just like we did not turn Afghanistan into radioactive slag.
Right.
We had a very different mission. And credit needs to be given to Bush for not wanting to obliterate a country.
Yes, yes, yes. That's true. We are not as bad as the Galactic Empire.
God, no. They do set a high bar, but you know, you get people like Putin who goes, I can try.
I can try. Absolutely. Absolutely. Challenge
accepted.
Challenge accepted. I will give it a shot. Yeah.
Now, just so, again, I follow you on social media, but could you highlight some of the work that you've done with the Museum of Science Fiction?
Sure.
And you also have a relationship with the International Spy Museum.
I am. So that's correct. In reverse, I'm the IP lawyer for the Spy Museum. So, and IP, media, entertainment, and all of those related issues, copyrights and whatnot for the Spy Museum. Yeah, that's a lot of fun. And they're open now. I recommend everyone go. And yes, I'm also production counsel for the Museum of Science Fiction, which is a group of us here, principally located in Washington, but also throughout, America and the world, who are working toward building a world-class Museum of Science Fiction. It doesn't actually exist, it should. And we've been working toward that goal in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways that we've been doing it is, exhibitions and online things, and we are gathering the collections and we are gathering personnel. We run an academic journal, but we also put on an in-person convention, science fiction and science convention, called Escape Velocity, which we've done. We didn't do last year, obviously, because of the pandemic. And I think we're going to probably restart it in 2022. And an abundance of caution, but you're trying to show the intersection of science and science fiction and how one feeds off the other in both directions, right? So science, new discoveries in science obviously lead to new forms of science fiction. And of course, science fiction inspires people to become scientists and look for new things. And that's just the reality of it. Talk to any scientist, every single one of them were inspired to do what they do by watching science fiction, reading science fiction, and so on. So yeah, it's exciting. It's a lot of fun. I've always been a fan of the Legal Geeks. And what's funny is the nature of my practice, exactly what I do. I am the legal geek. Like, I literally have the most geek oriented legal practice possible. Like, that's it. Like, I represent the designers of the new edition of the Dune board game and Cosmic Encounter. So I'm like, yeah, I touch on everything. My fingers on all of this stuff. It's wild. It's a lot. That is
so
cool.
I love the Spy Museum.
It's great. Yeah.
I used to, when I worked for eDiscovery Software Company, went to DC frequently.
Yes.
And always made time to go by there. I haven't seen the new location yet, so I'm excited. Oh,
yes, it's wonderful. It's the new location is wonderful. Purpose built, obviously, by the Spy mm-hmm. Museum for this, and I can't say enough about how gorgeous it looks and how the physical structure of the museum is perfectly designed to tell the story, right? Like, they tell the story with the use of physical space, which just makes it an amazing experience. It's also highly interactive too.
Yeah, I can't wait to check it out. And Jessica, my co-founder, She's done Escape Velocity.
She has. And
the fact it was like around Memorial Day weekend, I have a scout event that I help out with.
I remember that. Like, right. You were, yes. I would next time.
Love to, yeah.
Next time.
Definitely. Would love to go help out because there's a, yeah, it's like, yeah, those are my people.
They are. We are
your people. Also, you know, what's funny is that as you probably, speaking specifically to the Legal Geeks, I mean, as you probably know, the Washington, D.C. area has the highest concentration of lawyers per capita in the country. Like, they, you know, we always joke about whenever you run into someone or meet someone new, you don't ask, what do? You ask, what kind of law do you practice? Because that's like, that's, yeah, you know, and it's almost not a joke. Nearly every one of my friends is a lawyer, right? And it isn't because I went to law school with all of them. I didn't. That's not, I went to law school with some of them, but no, nearly of them. And even if they aren't practicing lawyers, they're people with law degrees, right? And then, so take that, right? So that's that. And then of course, certainly was my experience and oh, we'll get back to the Spy Museum in a way too. My experience is that there was an enormous crossover between lawyer and science fiction and fantasy fan. Like, there are lots of us that are both of those things. I've also learned from being here and through contacts in the Spy Museum, but also one of my friends who was actually a lawyer who works at the CIA once told me that, Charles, you have no idea how many of the intelligence agencies are filled with people exactly like you. So, yeah, there we are your people. We are your people, Josh.
Yeah, again, and I love DC for a whole bunch of reasons. And yeah, again, who knew that people who read comics as kids and watched, you know, sci-fi movies would go on to law school? Like, there is a...
But it happened. Yeah. Yeah. I met, I don't know if you had this experience, but literally on my first day in law school, I sat down and the first person I ran into, we later became friends immediately, was a huge science fiction and fantasy fan, gamer, like right off the bat. Like, that's the person one I met.
It's just that that's the way it is. It's, yeah, we all do that. I don't know why.
Yeah.
People, it's, yeah, I know lots of lawyers who still play D&D.
Well, absolutely. I mean, my wife, who is also a lawyer, who is also a colossal science fiction and fantasy fan, and who is a gamer, and we all play role-playing games. And yeah, I mean, like, when I get together to play role-playing games, I got, yeah, it's exactly. I got, you know, Big Ten law partner. I got, you know, intelligence officers. I got all these people. That's who plays role-playing games with me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know that there's somebody at the Pentagon who wrote a Godzilla response plan.
Oh, yeah. Well, oh, by the way, so we have a, that's actually an aspect of Escape Velocity, not to toot that horn again, but we have a, there's a, you know, that part of the Pentagon and the intelligence agency, which is called the professional wargaming world, where people try to simulate conflicts and whatnot. We have a lot of those folks who come to Escape Velocity and put on programming. And you know, we get that crossover of, you know, I'm from the Center for Naval Intelligence, but I'm also here to talk about why aircraft carriers in science fiction aren't a good metaphor, or are a good metaphor, you know.
Yeah, well, again, separate discussion, but yes, love that sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing that panels should be. There's, because there's just so much there.
Yeah.
Like having, you know, talking about the, you know, starship designs and like what would make the most sense.
Right.
And one of the dogs heard a bird and went chasing out to defend his domain.
Can't blame him.
He does. But like, that's the content that people like gravitate towards, and like it works to talk about, you know, if you're going to talk about kaiju, have someone who is a zoologist or a vet, you know, talk about all of those aspects.
One of the things that's also kind of emerged recently is the we see increasingly an expression of science fiction, mainstream science fiction, that really does try to show some science, right? Like, and beyond Star Trek, I'm talking about The Expanse, right? Which, something like For All Mankind on Apple TV, where you have,
love that.
Yeah. And so that's been, that stuff fits, is just exactly what we talk about, you know, right? Well, what are orbital mechanics really like? And how does that influence, you know, how much fuel would you really need to get your fusion ship from Mars to Jupiter?
Good times. Well, Charles, this has been a ton of fun because we interact on social media often, but this is the first time that we've actually talked.
That's right. That's true. I've seen you talk on the Legal Geeks show quite a bit. So, yeah.
Thank you. Jessica's met you in person. So, like, there's,
that's right.
There's that. But again, we really want to thank you for sharing your collection and stories about from your dad. There's a wonderful panel from last year's virtual San Diego Comic-Con that has a panel with your uncle and William Stout and a few other famous artists, you know, who all did movie posters. And like, that was just amazing to watch.
I bet. That's great. That's great.
So highly, highly recommend that.
I will take a look.
Everyone, thank you so much. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay geeky. You all take care.